Chocolat by Joanne Harris. Read by Diana Bishop. February the 11th, Shrove Tuesday. We came on the wind of the carnival. A warm wind for February, laden with the hot, greasy scents of frying pancakes and sausages and powdery sweet waffles cooked on the hot plate right there by the roadside, with the confetti sleeting down collars and cuffs and rolling in the gutters like an idiot antidote to winter. There is a febrile excitement in the crowds which line the narrow main street, necks craning to catch sight of the crepe-covered shower with its trailing ribbons and paper rosettes. Anouk watches, eyes wide, a yellow balloon in one hand and a toy trumpet in the other, from between a shopping basket and a sad brown dog. We have seen carnivals before, she and I. A procession of 250 of the decorated Shah in Paris last Mardi Gras, 180 in New York, 24 marching bands in Vienna, clowns on stilts, the grosse tête with their lolling papier-mâché heads, drum majorettes with batons spinning and sparkling. But at 6 the world retains a special lustre. A wooden cart, hastily decorated with gilt and crepe and scenes from fairy tales. A dragon's head on a shield. Rapunzel in a woolen wig. A mermaid with a cellophane tail. A gingerbread house all icing and gilded cardboard. A witch in the doorway, waggling extravagant green fingernails at a group of silent children. At 6, it is possible to perceive subtleties which a year later are already out of reach. Behind the papier-mâché, the icing, the plastic, she can still see the real witch, the real magic. She looks up at me, her eyes, which are the blue-green of the earth seen from a great height, shining. Are we staying? Are we staying here? I have to remind her to speak French. But are we? Are we? She clings to my sleeve. Her hair is a candy floss tangle in the wind. I consider. It's as good a place as any. Lansquenet-sur-Tarn, 200 souls at most. No more than a blip on the fast road between Toulouse and Bordeaux. Blink once and it's gone. One main street, a double row of dun-coloured, half-timbered houses leaning secretively together, a few laterals running parallel like the tines of a bent fork, a church, aggressively whitewashed, in a square of little shops, farms scattered across the watchful land, orchards, vineyards, strips of earth enclosed and regimented according to the strict apartheid of country farming. Here apples, there kiwis, melons, endive beneath their black plastic shells, vines looking blighted and dead in the thin February sun, but awaiting triumphant resurrection by March. Behind that, the Tarn, small tributary of the Garonne, fingers its way across the marshy pasture. And the people? They look much like all others we have known. A little pale, perhaps, in the unaccustomed sunlight, a little drab. Headscarves and berries are the colour of the hair beneath, brown, black or grey. Faces are lined like last summer's apples, eyes pushed into wrinkled flesh like marbles into old dough. A few children, flying colours of red and lime green and yellow, seem like a different race. As the Shah advances ponderously along the street behind the old tractor which pulls it, a large woman with a square, unhappy face clutches a tartan coat about her shoulders and shouts something in the half-comprehensible local dialect. On the wagon, a squat Santa Claus, out of season amongst the fairies and sirens and goblins, hurls sweets at the crowd with barely restrained aggression. An elderly, small-featured man, wearing a felt hat rather than the round beret more common to the region, picks up the sad brown dog from between my legs with a look of polite apology. I see his thin, graceful fingers moving in the dog's fur. The dog whines. The master's expression becomes complex with love, concern, guilt. No one looks at us. We might as well be invisible. Our clothing marks us as strangers, transients. They are polite, so polite. No one stares at us. The woman, her long hair tucked into the collar of her orange coat, a long silk scarf fluttering at her throat. The child in yellow Wellingtons and sky blue mac. Their colouring marks them. Their clothes are exotic. Their faces, are they too pale or too dark? Their hair marks them other, foreign, indefinably strange. The people of Lansquenet have learned the art of observation without eye contact. I feel their gaze like a breath on the nape of my neck, strangely without hostility, but cold, nevertheless. We are a curiosity to them, a part of the carnival, a whiff of the outlands. I feel their eyes upon us as I turn to buy a galette from the vendor. The paper is hot and greasy, the dark wheat pancake crispy at the edges but thick and good in the centre. I break off a piece and give it to Anouk, wiping melted butter from her chin. The vendor is a plump, balding man with thick glasses, his face slick with the steam from the hot plate. He winks at her. With the other eye he takes in every detail, knowing there will be questions later. On holiday, madame? Village etiquette allows him to ask. Behind his tradesman's indifference, I see a real hunger. Knowledge is currency here. With Agen and Montauban so close, tourists are a rarity. For a while. From Paris, then? It must be our clothes. In this garish land, the people are drab. Colour is a luxury. It wears badly. The bright blossoms of the roadside are weeds, invasive, useless. No, no, not Paris. The Shah is almost at the end of the street. A small band, two fifes, two trumpets, a trombone and a side drum, follow it, playing a thin, unidentifiable march. A dozen children scamper in its wake, picking up the unclaimed sweets. Some are in costume. I see Little Red Riding Hood, and a shaggy person who might be the wolf, squabbling companionably over possession of a handful of streamers. A black figure brings up the rear. At first I take him for a part of the parade, the plague doctor, maybe. But as he approaches, I recognize the old-fashioned soutane of the country priest. He's in his 30s, though from a distance his rigid stance makes him seem older. He turns towards me, and I see that he too is a stranger, with the high cheekbones and pale eyes of the north, and long pianist's fingers resting on the silver cross which hangs from his neck. Perhaps this is what gives him the right to stare at me, this alienness. But I see no welcome in his cold, light eyes, only the measuring, feline look of one who is uncertain of his territory. I smile at him. He looks away, startled, beckons the two children towards him. Her gesture indicates the litter which now lines the road. Reluctantly the pair begin to clear it, scooping up spent streamers and sweet wrappers in their arms and into a nearby bin. I catch the priest staring at me again as I turn away, a look which in another man might have been of appraisal. There is no police station at Lansquenet-sur-Tarn, therefore no crime. I try to be like Anouk, to see beneath the disguise to the truth. But for now, everything is blurred. Are we staying? Are we, Maman? She tugs at my arm insistently. I like it. I like it here. Are we staying? I catch her up into my arms and kiss the top of her head. She smells of smoke and frying pancakes and warm bedclothes on a winter's morning. Why not? It's as good a place as any. Yes, of course, I tell her, my mouth in her hair. Of course we are. Not quite a lie. This time it may even be true. The carnival is gone. Once a year the village flares into transient brightness, but even now the warmth has faded, the crowd dispersed. The vendors pack up their hot plates and awnings, the children discard their costumes and party favours. A slight air of embarrassment prevails, of abashment at this excess of noise and colour. Like rain in midsummer, it evaporates, runs into the cracked earth and through the parched stones, leaving barely a trace. 2 hours later, Lansquenet-sur-Tarn is invisible once more, like an enchanted village which appears only once every year. But for the carnival, we should have missed it altogether. We have gas, but as yet no electricity. On our first night, I made pancakes for Anouk by candlelight, and we ate them by the fireside, using an old magazine for plates, as none of our things can be delivered until tomorrow. The shop was originally a bakery, and still carries the baker's wheat sheaf carved above the narrow doorway. But the floor is thick with a floury dust, and we picked our way across a drift of junk mail as we came in. The lease seems ridiculously cheap, accustomed as we are to city prices. Even so, I caught the sharp glance of suspicion from the woman at the agency as I counted out the banknotes. On the lease document, I am Vianne Rocher, the signature a hieroglyph which might mean anything. By the light of the candle, we explored our new territory. The old ovens still surprisingly good beneath the grease and soot. The pine-panelled walls, the blackened earthen tiles. Anouk found the old awning folded away in a back room, and we dragged it out, spiders scattered from under the faded canvas. Our living area is above the shop, a bedsit and washroom, ridiculously tiny balcony, terracotta planter with dead geraniums. Anouk made a face when she saw it. "It's so dark, Maman." She sounded awed, uncertain in the face of so much dereliction. "And it smells so sad." She's right. The smell is like daylight trapped for years until it has gone sour and rancid, of mouse droppings and the ghosts of things unremembered and unmourned. It echoes like a cave, the small heat of our presence only serving to accentuate every shadow. Paint and sunlight and soapy water will rid us of the grime, but the sadness is another matter. The forlorn resonance of a house where no one has laughed for years. Anouk's face looked pale and large-eyed in the candlelight, her hand tightening in mine. "Do we have to sleep here?" she asked. "Pontoufle doesn't like it. He's afraid." I smiled and kissed her solemn golden cheek. "Pontoufle is going to help us. We lit a candle for every room, gold and red and white and orange. I prefer to make my own incense, but in a crisis the bought sticks are good enough for our purposes, lavender and cedar and lemongrass." We each held a candle, Anouk blowing her toy trumpet and I rattling a metal spoon in an old saucepan, and for 10 minutes we stamped around every room, shouting and singing at the top of our voices, "Out! Out! Out!" until the walls shook and the outraged ghosts fled, leaving in their wake a faint scent of scorching and a good deal of fallen plaster. Look behind the cracked and blackened paintwork, behind the sadness of things abandoned, and begin to see faint outlines like the afterimage of a sparkler held in the hand. Here, a wall adazzle with golden paint. There, an armchair, a little shabby, but coloured a triumphant orange. The old awning suddenly glowing as half-hidden colours slide out from beneath the layers of grime. Out, out, out. Anouk and Pontoufle stamped and sang, and the faint images seem to grow brighter. A red stool beside the vinyl counter. A string of bells against the front door. Of course I know it's only a game. Glamours to comfort a frightened child. There'll have to be work done, hard work, before any of this becomes real. And yet for the moment it is enough to know that the house welcomes us, as we welcome it. Rock salt and bread by the doorstep to placate any resident gods. Sandalwood on our pillow to sweeten our dreams. Later, Anouk told me Pontoufle wasn't frightened anymore, so that was all right. We slept together in our clothes on the flowery mattress in the bedroom, with all the candles burning. And when we awoke, it was morning. February the 12th, Ash Wednesday. Actually, the bells woke us. I hadn't realized quite how close we were to the church until I heard them. A single, low, resonant drone falling into a bright carillon. Dum, fla-di-da-di-dum, on the downbeat. I looked at my watch. It was 6 o'clock. Grey-gold light filtered through the broken shutters onto the bed. I stood up and looked out onto the square, wet cobbles shining. The square white church tower stood out sharply in the morning sunlight, rising from a hollow of dark shop fronts. A bakery, a florist, a shop selling graveyard paraphernalia, plaques, stone angels, enamelled everlasting roses. Above their discreetly shuttered facades, the white tower is a beacon, the Roman numerals of the clock gleaming redly at 6:20 to baffle the devil. The Virgin, in her dizzy eyrie, watching the square with a faintly sickened expression. At the tip of the short spire, a weather vane turns, west to west-northwest, a robed man with a scythe. From the balcony with the dead geranium, I could see the first arrivals to Mass. I recognized the woman in the tartan coat from the carnival. I waved to her, but she hurried on without an answering gesture, pulling her coat protectively around her. Behind her, the felt-hatted man with his sad brown dog in tow gave me a hesitant smile. I called down brightly to him, but seemingly village etiquette did not allow for such informalities, for he did not respond, hurrying in his turn into the church, taking his dog with him. After that, no one even looked up at my window, though I counted over 60 heads. Scarves, berets, hats drawn down against an invisible wind. But I felt their studied, curious indifference. They had matters of importance to consider, said their hunched shoulders and lowered heads. Their feet dragged sullenly at the cobbles, like the feet of children going to school. This one has given up smoking today, I knew. That one his weekly visit to the cafe. Another will forego her favourite foods. It's none of my business, of course. But I felt at that moment that if ever a place were in need of a little magic. Old habits never die, and when you've once been in the business of granting wishes, the impulse never quite leaves you. And besides, the wind, the carnival wind, was still blowing, bringing with it the dim scent of grease and candy floss and gunpowder, the hot sharp scents of the changing seasons, making the palms itch and the heart beat faster. For a time, then, we stay. For a time. Till the wind changes. We bought the paint in the general store, and with it brushes, rollers, soap and buckets. We began upstairs and worked downwards, stripping curtains and throwing broken fittings onto the growing pile in the tiny back garden, soaping floors and making tidal waves down the narrow, sooty stairway, so that both of us were soaked several times through. Anouk's scrubbing brush became a submarine, and mine a tanker, which sent noisy soap torpedoes scudding down the stairs and into the hall. In the middle of this I heard the doorbell jangle, and looked up, soap in one hand, brush in the other, at the tall figure of the priest. I'd wondered how long it would take him to arrive. He considered us for a time, smiling. A guarded smile, proprietary, benevolent. The lord of the manor welcomes inopportune guests. I could feel him very conscious of my wet and dirty overalls, my hair caught up in a red scarf, my bare feet in their dripping sandals. Good morning. There was a rivulet of scummy water heading for his highly polished black shoe. I saw his eyes flick towards it and back towards me. Francis Renault, he said, discreetly sidestepping. Cure of the parish. I laughed at that. I couldn't help it. Oh, that's it, I said maliciously. I thought you were with the carnival. Polite laughter. Ha, ha, ha. I held out a yellow plastic glove. Viens, Rocher. And the bombardier back there is my daughter Anouk. Sounds of soap explosions, and of Anouk fighting Pantoufle on the stairs. I could hear the priest waiting for details of Mr. Rocher. So much easier to have everything on a piece of paper, everything official. Avoid this uncomfortable, messy conversation. I suppose you're very busy this morning. I suddenly felt sorry for him, trying so hard, straining to make contact. Again the forced smile. Yes, we really need to get this place in order as soon as possible. It's going to take time. But we wouldn't have been at church this morning anyway, Monsieur le Curé. We don't attend, you know. It was kindly meant, to show him where we stood, to reassure him. But he looked startled, almost insulted. I see. It was too direct. He would have liked us to dance a little, to circle each other like wary cats. But it's very kind of you to welcome us, I continued brightly. You might even be able to help us make a few friends here. He is a little like a cat himself, I notice. Cold, light eyes which never hold the gaze. A restless watchfulness, studied, aloof. I'll do anything I can. He is indifferent now he knows we are not to be members of his flock. And yet his conscience pushes him to offer more than he is willing to give. Have you anything in mind? Well, we could do with some help here, I suggested. Not you, of course, quickly as he began to reply. But perhaps you know someone who could do with the extra money. A plasterer, someone who might be able to help with the decorating. This was surely safe territory. I can't think of anyone. He is guarded, more so than anyone I have ever met. But I'll ask around. Perhaps he will. He knows his duty to the new arrival. But I know he will not find anyone. His is not a nature which grants favours graciously. His eyes flicked warily to the pile of bread and salt by the door. For luck, I smiled, but his face was stony. He skirted the little offering as if it offended him. Maman? Anouk's head appeared in the doorway, hair standing out in crazy spikes. Pantoufle wants to play outside. Can we? I nodded. Stay in the garden. I wiped a smudge of dirt from the bridge of her nose. You look a complete urchin. I saw her glance at the priest and caught her comical look just in time. This is Monsieur Renaud, Anouk. Why don't you say hello?
Hello,
shouted Anouk on the way to the door.
Goodbye.
A blur of yellow jumper and red overalls and she was gone, her feet skidding manically on the greasy tiles. Not for the first time, I was almost sure I saw Pantoufle disappearing in her wake, a darker smudge against the dark lintel. She's only six, I said, by way of explanation. Renaud gave a tight, sour smile, as if his first glimpse of my daughter confirmed every one of his suspicions about me. Thursday, February the 13th. Thank God that's over. Visits tire me to the bone. Oh, I don't mean you, of course, mon père. My weekly visit to you is a luxury. You might almost say my only one. I hope you like the flowers. They don't look much, but they smell wonderful. I'll put them here beside your chair, where you can see them. It's a good view from here across the fields, with the Tarn in the middle distance and the Garonne gleaming in the far. You might almost imagine we were alone. Oh, I'm not complaining. Not really. But you must know how heavy it is for one man to carry. Their petty concerns, their dissatisfactions, their foolishnesses, their thousand trivial problems. On Tuesday it was the carnival. Anyone might have taken them for savages, dancing and screaming. Louis Perrin's youngest, Claude, fired a water pistol at me. And what would his father say but that he was a youngster and needed to play a little? All I want is to guide them, mon père, to free them from their sin. But they fight me at every turn, like children refusing wholesome fare in order to continue eating what sickens them. I know you understand. For 50 years you held all this on your shoulders in patience and strength. You earned their love. Have times changed so much? Here I am feared, respected, but loved, no. Their faces are sullen, resentful. Yesterday they left the service with ash on their foreheads and a look of guilty relief. Left to their secret indulgences, their solitary vices. Don't they understand? The Lord sees everything. I see everything. Paul Marie Musca beats his wife. He pays 10 aves weekly in the confessional and leaves to begin again in exactly the same way. His wife steals. Last week she went to the market and stole trumpery jewellery from a vendor's stall. Guillaume Duplessis wants to know if animals have souls and weeps when I tell him they don't. Charlotte Edouard thinks her husband has a mistress. I know he has three, but the confessional keeps me silent. What children they are! Their demands leave me blooded and reeling, but I cannot afford to show weakness. Sheep are not the docile, pleasant creatures of the pastoral idyll. Any countryman will tell you that. They are sly, occasionally vicious, pathologically stupid. The lenient shepherd may find his flock unruly, defiant. I cannot afford to be lenient. That is why once a week I allow myself this one indulgence. Your mouth is as closely sealed, mon père, as that of the confessional. Your ears are always open, your heart always kind. For an hour I can lay aside the burden, I can be fallible. We have a new parishioner, Evianne Rocher, a widow, I take it, with a young child. Do you remember old Blaireau's bakery? 4 years since he died, and the place has been going to ruin ever since. Well, she has taken the lease on it, and hopes to reopen by the end of the week. I don't expect it to last. We already have Poitou's bakery across the square, and besides, she'll never fit in. Oh, pleasant enough woman, but she has nothing in common with us. Give her 2 months and she'll be back to the city where she belongs. Funny, I never did find out where she was from. Paris, I expect, or maybe even across the border. Her accent is pure, almost too pure for a French woman, with the clipped vowels of the north, though her eyes suggest Italian or Portuguese descent, and her skin... But I didn't really see her. She worked in the bakery all yesterday and today. There is a sheet of orange plastic over the window, and occasionally she or her little wild daughter appears to tip a bucket of dirty water into the gutter, or to talk animatedly with some workman or other. She has an odd facility for acquiring helpers. Though I offered to assist her, I doubted whether she would find many of our villagers willing. And yet I saw Clermont early this morning carrying a load of wood, then Porceau with his ladders. Poitou sent some furniture. I saw him carrying an armchair across the square with the furtive look of a man who does not wish to be seen. Even that ill-tempered backbiter Narcisse, who flatly refused to dig over the churchyard last November, went over there with his tools to tidy up her garden. This morning at about 8:40, a delivery van arrived in front of the shop. Duplessis, who was walking his dog at the usual time, was just passing at that moment, and she called him over to help her unload. I could see he was startled by the request. For a second I was almost certain he would refuse, one hand halfway to his hat. She said something then, I didn't hear what it was, and I heard her laughter ringing across the cobbles. She laughs a great deal, and makes many extravagant comical gestures with her arms. Again a city trait, I suppose. We are accustomed to a greater reserve in the people around us. But I expect she means well. A violet scarf was knotted gypsy fashion around her head, but most of her hair had escaped from beneath it and was streaked with white paint. She didn't seem to mind. Duplessis could not recall later what she had said to him, but said in his diffident way that the delivery was nothing, only a few boxes, small but quite heavy, and some open crates containing kitchen utensils. He did not ask what was in the boxes, though he doubts such a small supply of anything would go very far in a bakery. Do not imagine, mon père, that I spent my day watching the bakery. It is simply that it stands almost immediately opposite my own house, the one which was yours, mon père, before all this. Throughout the last day and a half there has been nothing but hammering and painting and whitewashing and scrubbing, until in spite of myself I cannot help but be curious to see the result. I'm not alone in this. I overheard Madame Clermont gossiping self-importantly to a group of friends outside Poitou's of her husband's work. There was talk of red shutters before they noticed me and subsided into sly muttering. As if I cared. The new arrival has certainly provided food for gossip, if nothing else. I find the orange-covered window catches the eye at the strangest times. It looks like a huge bonbon waiting to be unwrapped, like a remaining slice of the carnival. There is something unsettling about its brightness and the way the plastic folds catch the sun. I will be happy when the work is finished and the place is a bakery once more. The nurse is trying to catch my eye. She thinks I tire you. How can you bear them with their loud voices and nursery manner? Time for our rest now, I think. Her archness is jarring, unbearable. And yet she means kindly, your eyes tell me. Forgive them, they know not what they do. I am not kind. I come here for my own relief, not yours. And yet I like to believe that my visits give you pleasure, keeping you in touch with the hard edges of a world gone soft and featureless. Television an hour a night, turning 5 times a day, food through a tube. To be talked over as if you were an object. Can he hear us? Do you think he understands? Your opinions unsought, discarded. To be closed from everything, and yet to feel, to think. This is the truth of hell, stripped of its gaudy medievalisms. This loss of contact. And yet I look to you to teach me communication. Teach me hope. Friday, February the 14th, St. Valentine. The dogman's name is Guillaume. He helped me with the delivery yesterday, and he was my first customer this morning. He had his dog, Charlie, with him, and he greeted me with a shy politeness which was almost courtly. "It looks wonderful," he said, looking around. "You must have been up all night doing this." I laughed. "It's quite a transformation," said Guillaume. "You know, I'm not sure why, but I just assumed it was going to be another bakery." "What, and ruin poor Monsieur Poitou's trade? I'm sure he'd thank me for that, with his lumbago playing up the way it is, and his poor wife an invalid and sleeping so badly." Guillaume bent to straighten Charlie's collar, but I saw his eyes twinkle. "I see you've met," he said. "Yes, I gave him my recipe for bedtime tisane. If it works, he'll be a friend for life." "It works," I assured him. Then, reaching under the counter, I pulled out a small pink box with a silver Valentine bow on it. "Here, for you, my first customer." Guillaume looked a little startled. "Really, madame, I..." "Call me Vianne, and I insist." I pushed the box into his hands. "You like them? They're your favourite kind." He smiled at that. "How do you know?" he inquired, tucking the box carefully into his coat pocket. "Oh, I can just tell," I told him mischievously. "I know everyone's favourite. Trust me, this is yours." The sign wasn't finished until about noon. Georges Clermont came to hang it himself then, profusely apologetic at his lateness. The scarlet shutters looked beautiful against the new whitewash, and Narcisse, grumbling half-heartedly about the late frosts, brought some new geraniums from his nursery to put in my planters. I sent them both away with Valentine boxes and similar expressions of bemused pleasure. After that, barring a few schoolchildren, I had few visitors. It is always the case when a new shop opens in such a small village. There is a strict code of behaviour governing such situations, and people are reserved, pretending indifference, though inwardly they burn with curiosity. An old lady ventured in, wearing the traditional black dress of the country widow. A man with dark, florid features bought 3 identical boxes without asking what was inside. Then, for hours, no one came. It was what I expected. People need time to adapt to change, and though I caught several sharp glances at my display window, no one seemed inclined to go in. Behind the studied unconcern, however, I sensed a kind of seething, a whispering of speculation, a twitching of curtains, gathering of resolve. When at last they came, it was together, 7 or 8 women. Caroline Clermont, wife of the signmaker, amongst them. A 9th, arriving somewhat behind the group, remained outside, her face almost touching the window, and I recognised the woman in the tartan coat. The ladies eyed everything, giggling like schoolgirls, hesitant, delighting in their collective naughtiness. "And you make them all yourself?" asked Cecile, who owns the pharmacy on the main street. "I should be giving it up for Lent," commented Caroline, a plump blonde with a fur collar. "I won't tell a soul," I promised. Then, observing the woman in the tartan coat still gazing into the window, "Won't your friend join us?"
"Oh, she isn't with us," replied Jolene Drew, a sharp-featured woman who works at the local school.
She glanced briefly at the square-faced woman at the window.
"That's Josephine Muscat."
There was a kind of pitying contempt in her voice as she pronounced the name.
"I doubt she'll come in."
As if she had heard, I saw Josephine redden slightly, lowering her head against the breast of her coat. One hand was drawn up against her stomach in an odd protective gesture. I could see her mouth perpetually downturned, moving slightly, in the rhythms of prayer or cursing. I served the ladies a white box, gold ribbon, 2 peppercorni, a rose, a pink valentine bow, amidst exclamations and laughter. Outside, Josephine Muscat muttered and rocked and dug her large, ungainly fists into her stomach. Then, just as I was serving the last customer, she raised her head in a kind of defiance and walked in. This last order was a large and rather complicated one. Madame wanted just such a selection in a round box with ribbons and flowers and golden hearts and a calling card left blank. At this, the ladies turned up their eyes in roguish ecstasy, so that I almost missed the moment. The large hands are surprisingly nimble, rough, quick hands reddened with housework. One stays lodged in the pit of the stomach, the other flutters briefly at her side like a gunslinger's swift draw, and the little silver packet with the rose, marked 10 francs, has gone from the shelf and into the pocket of her coat. Nice work. I pretended not to notice until the ladies had left the shop with their parcels. Josephine, left alone in front of the counter, pretended to examine the display, turned over a couple of boxes with nervous, careful fingers. I closed my eyes. The thoughts she sent me were complex, troubling. A rapid series of images flickered through my mind. Smoke, a handful of gleaming trinkets, a blooded knuckle. Behind it all, a jittering undercurrent of worry.
"Madame Muscat, may I help you?"
My voice was soft and pleasant. "Or would you just like to look around?" She muttered something inaudible, turned as if to leave.
"I think I may have something you'll like."
I reached under the counter and brought out a silver packet, similar to the one I had seen her take, though this one was larger. A white ribbon secured the package, sewn with tiny yellow flowers. She looked at me, her wide, unhappy mouth drooping with a kind of panic. I pushed the packet across the counter towards her.
"On the house, Josephine," I told her gently. "It's all right. They're your favourites."
Josephine Muscat turned and fled.
Saturday, February the 15th. I know this isn't my usual day, mon père, but I needed to talk. The bakery opened yesterday, but it isn't a bakery. When I awoke yesterday morning at 6, the wrapping was off, the awning and the shutters were in place, and the blind was raised in the display window. What was an ordinary, rather drab old house like all the others around it has become a red and gold confection on a dazzling white ground. Red geraniums in the window boxes, crepe paper garlands twisted around the railings, and above the door a hand-lettered sign in black on oak. La Céleste Praline, Chocolaterie Artisanale. Of course it's ridiculous. Such a shop might well be popular in Marseille or Bordeaux, even in Agen, where the tourist trade grows every year. but in Lansquenet-sur-Tarn, and at the beginning of Lent, the traditional season of self-denial. It seems perverse, perhaps deliberately so. I looked into the display window this morning. On a white marble shelf are aligned innumerable boxes, packages, cornets of silver and gold paper, rosettes, bells, flowers, hearts, and long curls of multicoloured ribbon. In glass bells and dishes lie the chocolates, the praline, Venus's nipples, truffles, mondion, candied fruits, hazelnut clusters, chocolate seashells, candied rose petals, sugared violets. Protected from the sun by the half-blind which shields them, they gleam darkly, like sunken treasure, Aladdin's cave of sweet clichés. And in the middle she has built a magnificent centerpiece, a gingerbread house, walls of chocolate-coated pain d'épices, with the detail piped on in silver and gold icing, roof tiles of Florentine, studded with crystallized fruits, strange vines of icing and chocolate growing up the walls, marzipan birds singing in chocolate trees, and the witch herself, dark chocolate from the top of her pointed hat to the hem of her long cloak, half astride a broomstick, which is, in reality, a giant guimauve, the long twisted marshmallows that dangle from the stalls of sweet vendors on carnival days. From my own window I can see hers, like an eye closing in a sly, conspiratorial wink. Caroline Clermont broke her Lenten vow because of that shop and what it sells. She told me in the confessional yesterday, in that breathless, girlish tone which goes so ill with her promises of repentance. "Oh, mon père, I feel so dreadful about it. But what could I do when that charming woman was so sweet? I mean, I never even thought about it until it was too late. Though if there's anyone who should give up chocolates, I mean, the way my hips have absolutely ballooned in the last year or two, it makes me want to die." Two aves. God, that woman. Through the grill I can feel her hungry, adoring eyes. She feigns chagrin at my abruptness. "Of course, mon père." "And remember why we fast for Lent, not for vanity, not to impress our friends, not so that we can fit into next summer's expensive fashions." I am deliberately brutal. It is what she wants.
"Yes, I am vain, aren't I?"
A tiny sob, a tear, blotted delicately with the corner of a lawn handkerchief. "Just a vain, foolish woman." "Remember our Lord, his sacrifice, his humility." I can smell her perfume, something flowery, too strong in this enclosed darkness. I wonder whether this is temptation. If so, I am stone. Four aves. It is a kind of despair. It frets at the soul, reduces it piece by piece, as a cathedral may be levelled over the years by the erosion of flying dust and fragments of sand. I can feel it chipping away at my resolve, my joy, my faith. I should like to lead them through tribulation, through wilderness. Instead, this languid procession of liars, cheats, gluttons, and pathetic self-deceivers. The battle of good and evil, reduced to a fat woman standing in front of a chocolate shop saying, "Will I, won't I?" in pitiful indecision. The devil is a coward. He will not show his face. He is without substance, breaking into a million pieces which worm their evil ways into the blood, into the soul. You and I were born too late, mon père. The harsh, clean world of the Old Testament calls to me. We knew then where we stood. Satan walked amongst us in flesh. We made difficult decisions. We sacrificed our children in the Lord's name. We loved God, but we feared him more. Don't think I blame Vianne Rocher. Indeed, I hardly think of her at all. She is only one of the influences against which I must fight every day. But the thought of that shop with its carnival awning, a wink against denial, against faith. Turning from the doorway to receive the congregation, I catch a movement from within. Try me, test me, taste me. In a lull between the verses of a hymn, I hear the delivery van's horn as it pulls up in front. During the sermon, the very sermon, mon père, I stop mid-phrase. Certain I hear the rustle of sweet papers. I preached with greater severity than usual this morning, though the congregation was small. Tomorrow I'll make them pay. Tomorrow, Sunday. when the shops are closed.
Saturday, February the 15th. School finished early today. By 12, the street was rampant with cowboys and Indians in bright anoraks and denim jeans, dragging their school bags. The older ones dragging on illicit cigarettes, with turned-up collars and half a nonchalant eye to the display window as they pass. I noticed one boy walking alone, very correct in grey overcoat and beret, his school cartable perfectly squared to his small shoulders. For a long moment he stared in at the window of La Céleste Praline, but the light was shining on the glass in such a way that I did not catch his expression. Then a group of four children of Anouk's age stopped outside, and he moved on. Two noses snubbed briefly against the window, then the children retreated into a cluster as the four emptied pockets and pooled resources. A moment of hesitation as they decided who to send in. I pretended to be occupied with something behind the counter. "Madame?" A small, smudgy face peered suspiciously up at me. I recognized the wolf from the Mardi Gras parade. "Now, I have you down as a peanut brittle man." I kept my face serious, for this purchase of sweets is serious business. "It's good value, easy to share, doesn't melt in your pockets, and you can get," I indicated with hands held apart, "oh, this much at least for 5 francs. Am I right?" No answering smile, but a nod, as of one businessman to another. The coin was warm and a little sticky. He took the packet with care. "I like the little gingerbread house," he said gravely. "In the window." In the doorway, the three others nodded shyly, pressing together as if to give themselves courage. "It's cool." The American word was uttered with a kind of defiance, like smoke from a secret cigarette. I smiled. "Very cool," I agreed. "If you like, you and your friends can come over and help me eat it when I take it down." Eyes widened. "Cool! Hyper cool! When?" I shrugged. "I'll tell Anouk to remind you," I told them. "That's my little girl." "We know. We saw her. She doesn't go to school." This last was uttered with some envy. "She will on Monday. It's a pity she doesn't have any friends yet, because I told her she could ask them over, you know, to help me with the displays." Feet shuffled, sticky hands held out, shoving and pushing to be first in line. "We can, I can, I'm Jeannot, Claudine, Lucie." I sent them out with a sugar mouse each, and watched them fan across the square like dandelion seeds in the wind. A slice of sunlight glanced off their backs one after the other as they ran. Red, orange, green, blue. Then they were gone. From the shaded arch of Saint Jerome's, I saw the priest, Francis Reynaud, watching them with a look of curiosity and, I thought, disapproval. I felt a moment's surprise. Why should he disapprove? Since his duty visit on our first day, he has not called again, though I have heard of him often from other people. Guillaume speaks of him with respect, Narcisse with temper, Caroline with that archness which I sense she adopts when speaking of any man under 50. There is little warmth in their speech. He is not a local, I understand, a Paris seminarian, all his learning from books. He does not know the land, its needs, its demands. This from Narcisse, who has had a running feud with the priest ever since he refused to attend mass during the harvesting season. "A man who does not suffer fools," says Guillaume, with that small gleam of humour from behind his round spectacles. That is to say, so many of us, with our foolish little habits and our unbreakable routines. He pats Charlie's head affectionately as he says it, and the dog gives his single solemn bark. "He thinks it's ridiculous to be so devoted to a dog," said Guillaume ruefully. "He's far too polite to say so, but he thinks it's inappropriate, a man of my age." Before his retirement, Guillaume was a master at the local school.
There are only two teachers there now to deal with the falling numbers, though many of the older people still refer to Guillaume as le maître d'école. I watch as he scratches Charlie gently behind the ears, and I am sure I sense the sadness I saw in him at the carnival, a furtive look which is almost guilt. A man of any age can choose his friends where he likes, I interrupted with some heat. Perhaps Monsieur le Curé could learn a few things from Charlie himself. Again that sweet, sad, almost smile. Monsieur le Curé tries his best, he told me gently. We should not expect more. I did not answer. In my profession, it is a truth quickly learned that the process of giving is without limits. Guillaume left La Praline with a small bag of Florentines in his pocket. Before he had turned the corner of Avenue des Francs-Bourgeois, I saw him stoop to offer one to the dog. A pat, a bark, a wagging of the short, stubby tail. As I said, some people never have to think about giving. The village is less strange to me now, its inhabitants too. I am beginning to know faces, names, the first secret skeins of histories twisting together to form the umbilical which will eventually bind us. It is a more complex place than its geography at first suggests. The Rue Principale, forking off into the hand-shaped branch of laterals, Avenue des Poètes, Rue des Francs-Bourgeois, Ruelle des Frères de la Révolution, someone amongst the town planners had a fierce Republican streak. My own square, Place Saint-Jérôme, is the culmination of these reaching fingers, the church standing white and proud in an oblong of linden trees, the square of red shingle where the old men play pétanque on fine evenings. Behind it the hill falls away sharply towards that region of narrow streets collectively called Les Marais. This is Lansquenet's tiny slum, close half-timbered houses staggering down the uneven cobbles towards the town. Even there it is some distance before the houses give way to marshland. Some are built on the river itself, on platforms of rotting wood. Dozens flank the stone embankment, long fingers of damp reaching towards their small high windows from the sluggish water. In a town like Agen, Les Marais would attract tourists for its quaintness and rustic decay. But here there are no tourists. The people of Les Marais are scavengers, living from what they can reclaim from the river. Many of their houses are derelict. Elder trees grow from the sagging walls. I closed La Praline for 2 hours at lunch, and Anouk and I went walking down towards the river. A couple of skinny children dabbled in the green mud by the waterside. Even in February there was a mellow stink of sewage and rot. It was cold but sunny, and Anouk was wearing her red woolen coat and hat, racing along the stones and shouting to Pantoufle, scampering in her wake. I have become so accustomed to Pantoufle and to the rest of the strange menagerie which she trails in her bright wake, that at such times I can almost see him clearly. Pantoufle, with his grey-whiskered face and wise eyes, the world suddenly brightening, as if by a strange transference I have become Anouk, seeing with her eyes, following where she travels. At such times, I feel I could die for love of her, my little stranger, my heart swelling dangerously, so that the only release is to run, too, my red coat flapping around my shoulders like wings, my hair a comet's tail in the patchy blue sky. A black cat crossed my path, and I stopped to dance around it widdershins, and to sing the rhyme, Où vas-tu, mistigri? Passe sans faire de mal ici. Anouk joined in, and the cat purred, rolling over into the dust to be stroked. I bent down and saw a tiny old woman watching me curiously from the angle of a house. Black skirt, black coat, grey hair coiled and plaited into a neat, complex bun. Her eyes were sharp and black as a bird's. I nodded to her. "You're from the chocolaterie," she said. Despite her age, which I took to be 80, maybe more,
Her voice was brisk and strongly accented with the rough lilt of the midi.
Yes, I am.
I gave my name.
Armande Voisin, she said. That's my house over there.
She nodded towards one of the river houses, this one in better repair than the rest, freshly whitewashed and with scarlet geraniums in the window boxes. Then, with a smile which worked her apple doll face into a million wrinkles, she said,
I've seen your shop. Pretty enough, I'll grant you that. But no good to folks like us. Much too fancy.
There was no disapproval in her voice as she spoke, but a half-laughing fatalism.
I hear our Monsieur le Curé already has it in for you, she added maliciously. I suppose he thinks a chocolate shop is inappropriate in his square.
She gave me another of those quizzical, mocking glances.
Does he know you're a witch? She asked.
Witch. Witch, it's the wrong word. But I knew what she meant.
What makes you think that? Oh, it's obvious. Takes one to know one, I expect.
And she laughed, a sound like violins gone wild.
Monsieur le Curé doesn't believe in magic, she said. Tell you the truth, I wouldn't be so sure he even believes in God.
There was indulgent contempt in her voice.
He has a lot to learn, that man, even if he has got a degree in theology. And my silly daughter, too. You don't get degrees in life, do you?
I agreed that you didn't, and inquired whether I knew her daughter.
I expect so. Caro Clermont, the most empty-headed piece of foolishness in all of Lascanais. Talk, 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 and not a particle of sense.
She saw my smile, and nodded cheerily.
Don't worry, dear. At my age, nothing much offends me any more. And she takes after her father, you know. That's a great consolation.
She looked at me quizzically.
You don't get much entertainment around here, she observed, especially if you're old.
She paused and peered at me again.
But with you, I think maybe we're in for a little amusement.
Her hand brushed mine like a cool breath. I tried to catch her thoughts, to see if she was making fun of me, but all I felt was humour and kindness.
It's only a chocolate shop, I said with a smile.
Armand Voisin chuckled.
You really must think I was born yesterday, she observed.
Really, Madame Voisin?
Call me Armand.
The black eyes snapped with amusement. It makes me feel young.
All right.
But I really don't see why.
I know what wind you blew in on, said Armand keenly. I felt it. Mardi Gras, Carnival Day. Les Marauds was full of carnival people, gypsies, Spaniards, tinkers, pieds noirs, and undesirables. I knew you at once, you and your little girl. What are you calling yourselves this time?
Vienne Rocher. I smiled, and this is Anouk.
Anouk, repeated Armand softly. And the little grey friend? My eyes aren't as good as they used to be. What is it, a cat, a squirrel?
Anouk shook her curly head.
He's a rabbit, she said with cheery scorn, called Pantoufle.
Oh, a rabbit, of course.
Armand gave me a sly wink.
You see, I know what wind you blew in on. I've felt it myself once or twice. I may be old, but no one can pull the wool over my eyes. No one at all.
I nodded.
Maybe that's true, I said.
Come over to La Praline one day. I know everyone's favourite. I'll treat you to a big box of yours. Armand laughed.
Oh, I'm not allowed chocolate. Caro and that idiot doctor won't allow it, or anything else I might enjoy, she added wryly. First smoking, then alcohol, now this. God knows if I gave up breathing, perhaps I might live forever.
She gave a snort of laughter, but it had a tired sound, and I saw her raise a hand to her chest in a clutching gesture, eerily reminiscent of Josephine Muscat.
I'm not blaming them exactly, she said. It's just their way. Protection from everything. From life. From death.
She gave a grin which was suddenly very gamine in spite of the wrinkles.
I might call in to see you anyway, she said, if only to annoy the curé.
I pondered her last remark for some time after she disappeared behind the angle of the whitewashed house. Some distance away, Anouk was throwing stones onto the mud flats at the river bank. The curé. It seemed his name was never far from the lips. For a moment I considered Francis Reynaud. In a place like Lansquenet, it sometimes happens that one person, schoolteacher, café proprietor, or priest, forms the linchpin of the community. That this single individual is the essential core of the machinery which turns lives like the central pin of a clock mechanism, sending wheels to turn wheels, hammers to strike, needles to point the hour. If the pin slips or is damaged, the clock stops. Lansquenet is like that clock, needles perpetually frozen at a minute to midnight, wheels and cogs turning uselessly behind the bland blank face. Set a church clock wrong to fool the devil, my mother always told me. But in this case I suspect the devil is not fooled. Not for a minute.